This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
There is no solution because there is no problem, said Marcel Duchamp. A very Zen thing to say, perhaps. At least I thought so. Or a product of his cynicism about the capabilities of science and art. He said he didn't believe in truth, as a result, perhaps, of Jerry's pataphysics, if read as a science of improbable solutions. If William Anastasi's art is totally tautological, solipsistically successful, then why are we here? To explain what it does, or to explain what it does not? No problem, no solution. And yet, we don't stop talking. Modernism declared that art is free in such manifestos as Transition Magazine's Revolution of the Word. Art is free. Man is free, in Sartre's term, but we're not free of ourselves. Art is not free of itself. Leonardo da Vinci, in perhaps a happier time, saw disegno or linea as a branch of scientific inquiry. Drawing from models in the elemental world, he and we, through him, could come to understand the structures and functions of organisms, processes, patterns, such as the flow of water or the flight of birds. His drawing from nature was intentional and an organic process toward understanding. Semiotics, as the study of unmotivated sign systems, is a study of formal, if-shifting relations within a given grammatical structure. It presumes intentionality and a process toward meaning. In semiotics, there is no meaning except in relationship, not only in internal relationships within a sign system, but in relationship of reader, speaker, viewer to text, artwork. Now, in this post-aesthetic world here with William Anastasi, we know it is not a recently created world, but has a history within the evolution of art making. Donald Cuspid, in his recent book, The End of Art, refers to Duchamp's notion of aesthetic osmosis, transference from the artist to the spectator, taking place through the inert matter, the subjective mechanism which produces art in a, quote, raw state, which is informed by the artist's personal art coefficient, which Duchamp regards as an arithmetical relation between the unexpressed but intended and the unintentionally expressed. With regard to William's use of marks or traces, whether a revealed plaster surface in a wall displacement or an applied surface such as his abandoned paintings, pocket drawings, subway drawings, the surface is inflected. A nice example, which creates space and the implication of a message intended, erased, obscured, struggling to reachieve foregrounding if it ever inhabited it in the first place. Creating space through marking, the marks by their presence immerse the beholder in an ambiguous place, contiguous with all space in a nutshell, from Finnegan's Wake, in which the beholder, to use Gombrich's term, is uncertain of his ground. We are invited in by the scratchings, markings, and yet are we repelled? But we indulge in our inherent compulsion for reading, how to read the unpronounceable marks of, say, Anastasi's subway drawing or pocket drawings. They are a record of non-intentional movements beyond his control and imply signs not of his devising. They record his intention to mark, but not his intention to mean. Yet they give profound visual satisfaction, a visceral, spatial, sculptural, rhythmical satisfaction, even as we long to finish what we have not yet realized or made real. They are as complete as they will ever be in and of themselves. Vibrations, a partial pattern, a cosmic code are implied. Incremental repetition from some cryptic source. He gets ideas while meditating or running, as he said. Likewise, the 100-letter word thunder word that appears 10 times in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, and for which Anastasia is producing a series of large paintings in which each letter is embedded in a colorful, marked surface. They lure us inside the color, sound, explosion feeling of the remembered, reverberating, repetition that, as Joyce believed with Vico, was the instigation for civilization in driving early humans into caves, there to discover one another and language, as they cowered from the sound of God's voice. Is that in the paintings? Or is that association privileged only for Finnegan's Wake scholars? What if William Shem inspired autobiography? Well, we'll go back to that. He wrote, that is, William wrote on his own body, not every square inch, as did Shem, the first and last alchemist, in a paint that was not harmful to his skin, unlike the corrosive sublimation of his own obscene matter that Shem used, a text derived in part from youthful diaries written in Philadelphia, not the all-mood-molding, cycle-wheeling history of individual chaos. And what of Joyce's what if the Joyce-inspired 1,700-page manuscript may alter his egos? Is that right? All right. I'm sorry. I do apologize. Whatever. Cuspid is again useful in paraphrasing Duchamp for our purposes. Transference, he says, and he's using this in the sense of Freudian psychoanalysis, transference is the basic creative act, necessary emotional work that makes the material into art. The studio becomes a clinic in which the artist pursues self-cure, although he may end up with it self-expression, a self-mirroring or self-mimicking, perhaps, in artistic guise. Just as Joyce disguised himself as Shem, the dream persona of Stephen Dedalus, embedded in his secret alter ego, Alfred Jarry, as Anastasi claims, so is Anastasi disguising himself. By also writing on his own body and by producing a manuscript that resembles the surface look of Joyce's color-coded manuscripts of Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. We can't come to an appreciation, I think, of Anastasi's art by thinking, merely. The cerebral mental efforts are short-circuited. The intuitive feeling and kinetic aspects of our natures are appealed to. In fact, it is our spatial sense, our temporal sense, that are called into play and at once subverted, especially by his sculptural pieces and installations. It is our knowledge of lineage and influence that is thrown up to us in mimicry by his autobiography and may alter egos. The more we beholders indulge in a Barthesian writerly reading, foregrounding our associations precisely because of the paucity of affect in these strange works, the larger the work seems to become. As with Joyce's Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, we cannot read them. They can only be reread. William has stated that he meant to make the last work of art to go beyond aesthetics. If he has accomplished this, then gone forever is the Burkean awe. Vanished is any experience of the nature-inspired romantic sublime, a notion which has been vanishing actually for the last 100 years, so anyway. We are now on an urban material plane of used things, used ideas, reiterations, quashed potatoes. And yet, William and Tom McEvely used the word beautiful twice in an interview with regard to the marks made in his unsighted works. Marks left to chance seem to be the most satisfying or beautiful. How so? I find it so, and I do, but why? What we have then to hang on to is Anastasi's own phrase, simple. As simple, dumb even. As simple gives me a lovely feeling reminiscent of meditation, innocence, inspiration, perhaps the moment of death when thought, feeling, and action collapse into irresponsible and utter freedom. After weeks of pondering images, note-taking, destroying my clever first drafts, I decided to take him at his word, and I, too, the beholder, am going to become simple, dumb even. So I'm not going to tell you about how, in my reading of Todorov, I came momentarily to see William's work as Vickian language of gesture, what was known in the 18th century as the language of action. All Joyceans know that Joyce used Vico's new science as a trellis on which to hang Finnegan's Wake. In his system of cyclical history, the first era, the Age of Gods, is characterized by the language of gesture. Anastasi's uncited works certainly are the products of gesture, whether those of Anastasi himself, or of the more violent movements of a subway car, or of his hand playing with his pencil in his pocket. However, the gestural first language of men was motivated in the Saussurean sense. The gesture is primordial. Facial movements, etc., conform to what they express, but are not linear, but they are intentional, and they are motivated in that the gesture mark contains within its form the referent. Thus, Anastasi's marks, while they seem to imply a message, are traces only of accidental rhythmic movement. They are neither hieroglyphs nor pictograms. They are not intentional, as in pointing a finger to convey information, nor in the sense of a system of symbols. Rather, they might be considered a synecdoche of the processes he intentionally instigated that resulted in the unintentional marks. Let's see what else. That'll do. Seismograph. His marks signify themselves, record movement in time, space, and achieve a maximum degree of presence, to repeat. Affect without content. The mark is the thing designated more than it is the designator. They are not symbols. They are the implicit thingness of a sign, a conflation of past, already felt movement captured in material form. Is that right side up? So the dark part indicates the most pressure of your arm reach. And saw that band. The mark is the thing designated. His marks lure us with the promise of a message beyond their medium. They tease. They do not come through at a cognitive level. We remain content to be unsatisfied by the look of the agitated surface. This, I claim, is true, too, for Mialter's egos, but for a more complex reason. He has generated a long manuscript of 1,700 or so pages that has been exhibited as a work of art. Thus, it has two functions. Firstly, his mode and impetus of production is to pursue his scholarly connections between Joyce's text and his own readings into it for references to Jerry. He is aiming to establish influence. How many of us in this room do not have reams and boxes and folders and files bursting with similar material, the byproduct, however, of our own scholarly pursuits? Secondly, the look of the material, its formal structure, is mere appearance. How many of us have not experienced that frisson of encounter with a master's holographic manuscript? As a one-time textual scholar for about 20 years or so, working on Finnegan's Wake manuscripts and then late Yeats manuscripts, I never lost that thrill entering the world of the hand-marked pages of the genesis of a literary work of art. The textual scholar works backwards in time, rereading from finished book back through stages of development, back to the first markings, and then forward again to establish the process of creation, reading through crossings out, marginalia, blots, faded ink, smudged pencil marks, and the like, sitting where the author sat in front of that page, looking for that earliest crafting process, a detective, a forensic expert even. We must clear the mind of assumptions about intentionality at that stage, looking at the stops and starts, the alterations of another mind. What Anastasi gives us is his scholarly research in the guise of the color-coded manuscript pages that Joyce produced. Therefore, the look of his pages, handwritten on lined copybook paper using red, green, blue, and black, complete with encircled words, arrows, and the like, are displayed as an installation for the sake of surface appearance and deferentiality to his master Joyce. We, the gallery goers, are not meant to read the work from beginning to end. We are not invited to view it as linear readerly readers for content, but as beholders of a work of art that is simultaneously formal properties of color, shape, and surface, and see it as a work that has the added frisson of a hidden text, a cryptic message that, in this form, that is, on the wall all at once, is inaccessible. The display is both intrinsically what it is in itself and an allusion to or redigestion of another's production. Again, we are invited in by mark making to finish the work only to be pushed back already, eliminated from participation, from achieving meaning. Because I'm becoming dumb and simple, I am not going to describe how my reading of David Michael Levin's essay, The Phenomenon and Noumenon of Language, temporarily augmented my understanding of Anastasi's work. Emptiness is inseparable from luminosity, as the Rinpoche says in one of Levin's epigraphs. Is the simplicity, the dumbness of Anastasi's works the same as emptiness? Are they luminous? Or an occasion for achieving it, as a person can be an occasion for sin in the Catholic Church. Anastasi indulges his interest in the scatological at one or two removes, from Jerry through Duchamp, from Jerry through Joyce, by mimicking, not employing mimesis in Aristotle's sense. He can play within the freedom of the already seen, the already said, the predigested. Furthermore, I'm not going to belabor how Anastasi inadvertently achieves what the Russian formalist Viktor Shlavsky advised was the function of art, astronomy, to make strange. I'm only delighted to say that Anastasi's oeuvre seems to me to reside in the, quote, abyss between meaning and referent, I suppose akin to Duchamp's infrathin, or that space between flipping from one reading or to another of a gestalt form, which Escher then expanded. It's in that space that I'm interested in being. That space in which the mind must be still, silent, estranged from the very idea of meaning, but he creates occasions for a looping back or convulsion of memory that is perceived more as a feeling than as a thought. An inarticulatable idea, despite all that has been said about his work. Our verbiage fills a vacuum Anastasi's work provides, and we are not finished. It is more difficult to say, even, than to see. How do I feel about his tautologies, solipsisms, his deliberate intents to destroy metaphor, the very basis of learning? When Samuel Beckett wrote in his seminal essay that we've referred to earlier, Dante, Bruno, Vico, Joyce in Our Exagmenation, put out by Transition, of course, he stated that Fennigan's Wake, then known as Work in Progress, is not about anything. It is that thing. Beckett was already committing a work of literature and all its complex uses of subjective reality and the absence of presence and the presence of absence to what would become postmodernism and its commitment to tautology, to solipsism, self-referentiality, and what I would say is postmodernism's excremental vision from Dada to Kaka. And of course, you also realize that Kaka stood for Vienna. Kaiserlicht und Königlicht. If language exists between silence and affect, then what is the function of Anastasi's use of mark-making, of pre-linguistic signs, as in Abandoned Painting, Untitled, number 2, which I don't have a slide of. Are they simply silence or pure affect? There can be no meaningful silence until one has already spoken or gestured. Affect without language is meaningless. Language without affect is incommunicable. Anastasi's Marx traces imply a pre-linguistic attempt at communication akin to the pre-oral stage or anal erotic stage in Freudian terms. The pocket drawings, the subway drawings, the unsighted drawings, the autobiographies, Shem, Jerry, Double Shem, Me, Alters, Egos, are traces indicating a movement of a particular form, a return, a repeating back on itself, a bending double, a looping back, a bending over, as when one wipes oneself, as when Leopold Bloom disposes of the bit of newspaper he's been reading in the jacks, as when Shem collects the material for his stinksome inconstink, the fetal position, formally speaking, the association of defecation and creativity, psychologically speaking, the compulsive repetition of haunting memory that is neurosis. Shite, shit, merde, is a perfect Heideggerian thing in itself, tautologically speaking, and yet the perfect metaphor. In the end is my beginning view of creativity as well as redemption, and I don't mean T.S. Eliot. Try this Gedanken experiment. Take the end of a tube, the alimentary canal, twist it once, attach the ends, stoma to anastoma, mouth to anus, et voila. You've made a hollow Moebius band, an ideal final work of art that feeds on what it produces. And I would argue that the Moebius band is the formal structure of the text of Finnegan's Wake. Shit, it seems, has been in the air for 100 years, a Scheißgeist, you might say, certainly for the decadent fandesec French writers of whom Alfred Jarry was a prime mover and product, and for the symbolists, including Baudelaire and Eric Satie, who, as William once told me, had a penchant for pooping. They, through Arthur Symons, influenced the young James Joyce when he was in Paris studying medicine and living on lung stew. Any inherent fondness for the scatological residing in the young medical student was bound to have found artistic justification then, at the turn of the last century, just before Freud's interpretation of dreams of 1900, before such taboos were clinicalized. Even the young C.G. Jung, you will remember, was jolted by a dream vision of God pooping on his creation. Duchamp would tell James Johnson Sweeney that Dada was very useful as a purgative. Influenced by Cubism's fragmentation of form and surface and the utter freedom of returning to the anal erotic stage, as Freud by then had defined it, it seems quite valid to pay serious attention to the links Anastasi has established between Jerry and Duchamp and Jerry and Joyce. Remember those dirty letters young Joyce wrote to Nora in Trieste, and how Jim claimed she could outmatch him in smuttiness. What about the excremental vision of Anastasi? Take the example of William's deflated inner tube cum speaker, known as Untitled 1964. William's deflated inner tube, cum speaker, repeatedly performs the sound of its own air already having escaping, repeatedly hissing out. We can see or read it not only as a dead or dumb thing in itself, deflated, having already outlived its use as a piece of Heideggerian equipment, its usefulness having been literally drained from it, but we can also read it as a metaphor. For it is a form suggestive to me of an empty intestine, the sound of the escaping air as of escaping wind, gas, afflatus, merde, a used-up stinksome inconstinct flowing through the air valve, which is an anus, or mouth if you want to fill it up again. The speaker looks like a mouth or a vagina. If this is an auditory visual metaphor, then what is? Oh, just a note on influence, affiliation, appropriation. Art comes from other art, I think we all agree, in various ways. Influence tends to be conscious. Affiliation can be coincidental or synchronous. Appropriation, a reworking, as in bricolage, collage, mimicry, or plagiarism. And then its subcategory, misprision, in Harold Bloom's sense of a semi-deliberate misapprehension on grounds of the attempt to reinterpret. And I think perhaps William commits all of these. Anastasi has put himself in the stream of influence of Jerry, Joyce, Duchamp, and Cage on the one hand, and of influencing or being plagiarized by contemporaries on the other, including Kossuth, Smithson. What can I say? Great minds think alike. More interestingly, is there a thread or a code of sensibility that connects Anastasi's diverse works within his oeuvre? We know he was inspired and even freed by the diversity of Duchamp. John Cage put forth the idea that any noise can be music, an idea that had its precursor in Dada. And I think he came to that conclusion after his teacher Schoenberg in California told him he had no ear for harmony. So he went in other directions. Another freeing element, the scatological interests of Duchamp, of Jerry, and of Joyce. In his talk at the Sorbonne, which we've recently had a chance to listen to, addressing the 94 Joyce Symposium. William states that Scheit, Schitt, and Merdre were words characteristic of, I would say, male modernists with a literary bent, since Jerry first published it in the 1890s in Ubu. In other words, indicative of a reversion to that early Freudian stage of pre-adolescence, the anal, erotic, prior to the oral stage and contemporary with the Oedipal. In Joyce and Jerry, the Oedipal complex has been unresolved, hence the clinging and guilt over the mother's death, aligned with fascination with fecal matters. Stephen's Non Serviam is directed against church, state, and family, that is, against the patriarchy that his mother served and which killed her. And if you'll recall, he tells Gogarty and Ulysses, someone killed her. Someone killed her. However, I would argue rather than a postmodern art concern, scatological emphases denote a postmodern obsession rather than an aesthetic position, and I would say that Finnegan's Wake is a postmodern work in addition to being a product of the modernist interest in the unconscious, dream work, and the hidden life of the spirit. Joyce turns the dream world inside out in Finnegan's Wake, and because of the freedom inherent in the continuous present tense of the dream work, is free to indulge his lifelong impulses toward the scatological, from dirty knickers to playing with feces as primal mode of communication. Babies are known to do this around the age of one. I have personal evidence of this with my own son about 40 years ago. Certainly an infantile interest in proctological matters is not time-bound to any historical era, but the emphasis on caca in postmodern art is, as Cuspid says, regressive sublimation. In other words, if art is shit, there's no place left to regress to. With postmodern conceptual art in lieu of the spiritual, such as Kandinsky's Das Geistige in der Kunst, we can get cerebral or semiotic wit combined with anal or primal creativity, the latter in need of the former to legitimize it. Chance, the aleatory, as in the use of dice or I Ching, is its engine. If the artist eschews intentionality, is he then absolved of responsibility or responsibility in dream language, Finnegan's Wakeese, which implies you get punched out if you don't take responsibility. Very Sartrean idea, I think. With regard to tautology, in which everything is only itself, and we are beyond metaphoric associations, The self-referentiality of the work eliminates illusion through which the beholder might enter. Indeed, we are invited toward the work only to be ejected. We remain outside. It is as unsatisfying as falling in love with a narcissist, who, or which, like Joyce's daughter Lucia, is incapable of a cure because the transference cannot take place. Written language is silent language, a noise only in the head of the reader. What is the gestural of ideas not articulated but shown only? Anastasia is not, I think, in love with a particular material, nor with linguistic meaning, nor with the transcendent. He is interested in short-circuiting the linearity of linguistic thinking, of allowing an unspeakable process, however beautiful, as, say, in the water-rusted slab of steel, which is so attractive. Where was I? Of allowing an unspeakable process, however beautiful. But Bill, like Shem, has the powers of a thaumaturge. With his oil stick, his rubbing rock, he points the death bone and the quick are still. Insomnia, somnia, somniorum. And then a couple pages later, like Shem, with his pen and his brush and his pencil, he lifts the life wand and the dumb speak. Quack, 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 quack. The life wand, of course, is not only the tree's symbol of Finnegan's Wake, but also refers back to Stephen's ash plant with which he strikes the chandelier in the Circe episode of Ulysses before shouting, shite, to his mother's shade. Shite is the word known to all men, as Anastasi posits in his Sorbonne talk. Others, however, including Elman, always thought the word known to all men was love. Anastasia is an illustrator of ideas, crafting relationships into actual or illusory three-dimensionality, short-circuited ideas, ideas that are nearly completed and completely defeated in the beholder. His work creates what Levin calls a center of uncertainty, which we then strive to make back into a fixed certainty through looking and remembering, associating. Our minds become like the closed loop of his tape recorder recording itself. A metaphor for anxiety. Or of his video of the corner of the room reproducing itself. Quack, 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 quack. If Anastasi's efforts have been, as he said to Tom McEvely, to make the last work of art, to end art making, then if he has been successful, he should have also brought about the end of art criticism. But we have not quite come to a screeching halt. Paradoxically, the silences of tautologies invite a compulsive filling up of the void with language. Dumbness is no barrier for those of us who crave meaningfulness, if not a meaning, and our repetition compulsion to make connections with what we think we already know, what's been already said, what's already been seen, is unstoppable. We continue to look and ponder and speak and write, each thrown back into a individual chaos of associations. One of which comes to mind, a Zen anecdote about the path to awakening. Before enlightenment, mountains are mountains, streams are streams. Then, mountains are not mountains, and streams are not streams. But in the end, mountains are again mountains, and streams again are streams. And so, after finishing our connections with Anastasi's work, we return to ourselves as ourselves, but with the ego's demands destroyed, or at least thwarted. We are now emptied of theory, beyond aesthetics. Nothing is any longer like anything else in a metaphorical sense, or that is a numinous sense. The mind resides wordlessly in the thing in itself, which has its own dumb history, has its own existential indifference. We retreat to our thingness and what we and all things already are, even. Quiditas, emptiness. Namaste. Thanks. I have a footnote about this. But if you want to ask me a question, that's all right, too. Yes.
I was struck by your saying early on in your remarks, something to the effect that if we had reached a post-aesthetic type of art, then we've also lost worthy of awe.
Now, in a romantic sense, yes.
Now,
is there all that you feel about some of his work?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I would, yes, I see what you mean, certainly with Roscoe. And Newman's surfaces. Yes, so I see it as that, as saying, like be
bomb
here now.
If that kind of dark vision of wall over wall is sublime.
Within that, yes, I can see that. Because it is a way of being here now, of presence.
So that's all yeah. I wanted to say.
All right, yes. That gives me...
Gives up the sublime.
That's good. Thank you. Yes. This is one of a number of works similar to this.
Thank you.
by the way, this is in reverse. The one photograph of a photograph should be on the other side. So it's just reversing in your mind and you see it the way it's supposed to be. So you can see that the photograph of a full hand was taken before, obviously, the photograph of the hand holding the same photograph. And therefore, anyone really thinking about it would realize that the thumb nail, or the thumb holding the second photograph, is an infinite length longer than the thumb nail on the right.
Because I had time to grow between photos.
It was at least a minute later, yes.
Brilliant.
I said, now that's interesting.
Well, that brings up what I wanted to say about these last two things, and that is the issue of whether it's ever possible to make an absolute replica. I mean, the wall on the wall is clearly reduced by 10% because you had to leave the vent and the electrical outlet free. So it's a replica, clearly, because it's not totally obscuring the original. Right.
Well, one of my ideas was to actually obscure those.
I know you wanted to do
to make plaster casts, negative plaster casts of all the six discrete walls, and then make plaster positives from them so that you have plaster positives exactly of the air vents and the picture molding leaning against the wall. We didn't have time to do that.
So it would be one scale.
That was one of the ideas that we couldn't do, and I ended up settling for the slipstream canvases, 10% of each. But that's how I decided not to frustrate the air vents. If I could have done the other, I would have gone for it.
I see that the discussion about the view around the first thing we were thinking for about the work of.
I'm sorry, I can't hear
if
you.
If I compare the work of being with Joseph Koch,
yes,
about ontology, if I just want to say, okay, this is about information so dry, so empty of metaphor that maybe something might stop, because everything is going to be stopped. So supposing that, but it's not. Because in the other work, also, it may be transparent. Where the famous glass being. You get a sensation of amazed by the cleverness of it, or because of simplicity. But the case of me, always, nothing, always I can see, but I can give me and I was around. He overcome always the idea of ontology for fun. He creates some kind of sublime by doing that. And it probably is the reason why he didn't go together with the others. In the way of conceptualism, because he doesn't become only conceptual. And he's in a situation that every great artist is in which he contradicts completely his state. And that would make him look beautiful or look sublime or look different from the other artists.
I wasn't making any claims that anybody was copying or better than it. Really, really, believe me, because.
Something in the world, in any work of him, who overcome completely the work, it becomes something in which you don't stop the work. The works, I believe, as an artist, I'm an artist, you basically not a critic and not an curator. A good work of art should throw you away from the art. Always it's an object art. The work of art has always thrown you out of the icon. And this is a great quality of being something sublime. This man can be Victorian or can be human, by the way, super sublime, or can be somebody else. But you see, when you see the work of Paul, it's just a pose, you have enormous sensation. A few times I saw the object of Paul made me feel sublime. And I'm fascinated. What can make me feel other things, physically? No, but it's true. The idea of sublime is an idea which he has thought just all the time, this idea. Almost not only in this piece, it's also in the last piece. On the Jew, it's also, so radical the idea of a word to mean so many things, like overcome the idea of language. And this is why it's a poet, poetry, or something, like you don't understand if I see that.
Lawrence Weiner does it. Every time I call Lawrence Weiner a
It's very much like what I do in my own visual art. I'm very influenced by Japanese sumi painting and the endo Zen circus. And when you use that kind of ink and you do that kind of painting, there's no going back. You don't fix it later.
You can't escape yourself.
That's right. And yourself, as you are at that moment, is in that splash.
Tom, I would like to. Can't escape.
Yeah, right. So, is that it, Ben? I think that's it, right? Thanks very much.